You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, we're going to hear from two guests, Nigel Kerner in England and Dr. John Biggerstaff. Nigel is the author of two books, Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, and his previous work, The Song of the Grays. Dr. John Biggerstaff is a research associate professor in Tennessee who holds associate professorships in genome sciences and technology, biochemistry, molecular and cell biology, microbiology, environmental biotechnology, and nutrition. Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls expands upon Nigel's previous ideas on the genetic interception of our race and the profound danger it may create to our continued existence. He ends this work with a description of the importance of the Shroud of Turin, the image on which could only have been created by a huge release of intense light emanating from the body of Jesus during the process of transfiguration. Confirmation of the veracity of the Shroud and its creation would thus provide all of us with a mechanism to overcome the genetic control imposed by the Grays by following the example given to us by Jesus to live in a universe of light beyond the reach of material entities. So let's welcome these fascinating guests now. Hi, Nigel and John. How are you tonight?
We're fine tonight. A little bit cold. England seems to be rather in a cold snap at the moment, but I suppose it's nothing like the kind of ranges of temperature you guys get in the States. But it's a pleasure to talk to you all.
Wonderful.
Good evening. This is John Biggerstaff in Tennessee, and I don't think it's quite as cold here. And it's not so late in the night either. So perhaps I'm a little fresher here.
All right. Well, I think the easiest way to start this out, your book is fascinating, by the way. I've had many guests who have talked about alien abductions, and some who have even seen the, who've been on the ships and seen rows and rows of babies that are not crying, they're just laying there silent. And they said it was one of the most chilling sights that they've ever seen.
Yeah.
And also I've had Jim Sparks on, who has been abducted all his life. So some of the audience may have been abducted as well. So this should be really interesting for everybody. Yeah. I thought maybe we could start with both of you sharing your thoughts on the main ideas and concerns encompassed by your recent book.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole point about writing the books in the first place was because my son asked me a question that I actually knew nothing about at the time. He was 12 years old at the time, and he said, "Dad, are UFOs real?" And of course, I came at this from the point of view of, you know, the old interests we all had in Buck Rogers and that kind of thing and so on. And of course, I was an utter skeptic in the subject and so on. Yet my boy was a rather deep thinking individual, and I didn't want to give him a question that fobbed him off. And so I thought to myself, I'd better actually do some research into this and give him a cogent answer, something that wasn't dismissive, because I was skeptical about all this. So UFOs and so on. And of course I started this program of research into it, and well, I tell you what, it took me 28 years to give him a complete answer on most of the things that actually repercussions that came out of this investigation. And after 28 years I discovered it had turned on its head my entire philosophical ethos about the existential base of our race, of our species, the planet. And, you know, the UFO phenomenon I discovered was had a natural and obvious connection that ties science, religion, and philosophy at its most profound root. And this is the big shock that I had, that this whole thing came together when you looked for the reasons why this UFO phenomenon might be real in our physical reality sense, if you see what I'm trying to say. So this, as I say, Dad, are UFOs real? Led me to the most amazing series of discoveries that I've just had to put down on paper, and it's taken me three books to tell the complete story. And of course, I got it. It seems rather bizarre, doesn't it? A title like "Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls." How on earth you tie in ostensibly a subject about aliens in spaceships or flying saucers or whatever with this religious concept of a soul? And further than that, how do you get this thing associated with something like a religious relic like the Shroud of Turin? And really, this incredible situation where I connected up the dots and got to this incredible story is really the reason I'm here in front of this microphone talking to you. So, you know, that's really the scope, the scan, the full scan of all of this, really, basically. And Dr. Biggerstaff and another colleague of mine who really is an expert on the Shroud of Turin, somebody who delivered a wonderful dissertation at a recent scientific seminar in Frascati in Italy, the kind of, you know, rim, the most powerful work done in terms of research on the Shroud of Turin is done in Frascati in Italy at the moment by Italian scientists, actually international scientists, many of them American, proving that this incredible piece of cloth actually points the reason why this incredibly beautiful Jewish man, Yeshua ben Yosef, Joseph, to give him his Hebrew name, Jesus Christ, to in Christian purview, so to speak, how this particular thing is relevant to us all, individually, as a human species, or representative of a human species, if you see what I'm trying to say, Lance. And that's the whole kind of, you know, bandwidth of all of this. John is a cell biologist of some eminence, and of course we've been trying to look at this thing seriously through science. My own background's also soaked in science, trying to look at this seriously rather than the kind of frivolous takes people have, because as you say, you know, this business of abduction and so on is so profound in the lives of so many people and leaves so many people scarred by the experience. The fact that there is something here intercepting the affairs of our species, you know, that's something that's so disturbing, and many, many people really want to know what on earth's going on, so to speak, you know, and that's, I hope to give you some kind of take on this tonight.
Well, good, good. And, of course, one of my concerns would probably overlay both of yours, which is the rapid movement of technology willy-nilly into nanobiology, nanotechnology, and the concept that we are rapidly moving towards being roboticized and moved into a virtual existence. And
absolutely.
You know,
that's a profound thing you say there. I've written several articles published around the world in various science and magazines of repute, you know, trying to in a sense account for what all this might be and where is this thing going. We seem to be kind of steadily moving towards the transformation of our natural humanity into an artificial version of it.
Yes.
And our progress, you know, kind of towards what I call SIM card man is accelerating,
yes.
It seems, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you also mentioned briefly, there's a couple of things that you quote Cliff High and the Webbots, and he's a wonderful guest and a good friend. And I'm very familiar with his work, and you mentioned the Mayans and the 2012 shift. It's conceivable that Cliff's work overlaps with that of Terence McKenna's work with Time Wave Zero, which we're in right now, and that the Mayan shift has something to do with maybe a reset so that this kind of experience of moving into a SIM card man won't happen.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem. You see, the whole procedure, the procession that we seem to be involved in at the moment, you know, where we go kind of willy-nilly into the next technological breakthrough and the next and so forth, no sense of taking stock of where this all might lead. That's the greatest danger, Lance, because it seems to me that instead of looking 360 degrees around us when we make every single innovation that we do, if we don't do that, we will end up, incidentally almost, in a situation where we cannot pull ourselves away. And if, in fact, the UFO phenomenon is populated or instigated by some alien being that is, in fact, a robot itself or a roboid itself, if their technology is so far ahead of ours that they can come and dictate terms of reference, and maybe this is a point to give you a little story that makes that connection between this great individual they call Jesus Christ. By the way, I want to say that I'm not a religious person, and this is not some behest to believe in a religious ethos or whatever.
Right.
I really am a scientist. I don't really have any great sympathy with any kind of religious outlook in that sense, even though, as a child, somebody threw some water on me and called me a Roman Catholic. I managed to escape the grip of that by the age of 7, and I have been running away from it ever since and keeping out of the box.
Good for you.
However,
I think you made a wise choice.
Yeah. However, I did, you know, without intending it, kind of thing, land in the box because I was confronted with explanations that brought about a revelation as to how powerful this individual they called Jesus Christ might have been and what, in fact, his entire mission might have been intended to do. And I believe, you know, after studying this and all the old texts, particularly the ones they threw away in Christianity,
mm-hmm.
when you look at it, you find that this individual was trying, I believe, in a singular kind of drive to warn us about this business of the mechanization of our natural living humanity through the aegis, the auspices, if you like, of a alien type of roboidic, highly intelligent, programmed mechanism that is perhaps rather prevalent all over the universe, doing this particular thing, changing natural beings that come in with the Big Bang. You know, we can trace our ancestry back from, shall we say, from our present stance as a particular species and so on, through mom, dad, great-granddad, and great-great-granddad, and so on. Going all the way back, we have this connection. And I try to define that connection of information that ends in each individual, each one of us, as a soul. That simple track of information for each of us that comes down from the beginning to now. It's natural. It comes through birth, life, death, and birth, if you know what I mean. Whereas you create something like a robot or a roboid, give it artificial intelligence, you're doing it here, if you see what I'm trying to say. It doesn't begin anywhere except in some laboratory or some factory or some factorization that makes this particular thing happen. However, if you tell it, now look after yourself, robot, we program you to do this, and you go out there, look at dangers, look after our civilization, but make sure you survive, then the robot is likely, with its high intelligence, to come across, shall we say, worlds like ours, and say, hang on a minute, let's see what we can see, that is there a threat in these places to, you know, the robots program, whatever, and then we have a problem there because they might take the business into their own hands and start to marshal natural living species in the way they want to. I think, this is the interesting thing, Lance, I think they discovered on the Earth a species that could be born, something, a living entity. And this thing is wonderful because, you know, the robot, in the end, will end with everything in the universe. So the second law of thermodynamics, for instance, rots everything. It's all going one way. And the robot knows its subject to this breakup, whatever. But we can keep going because we're born again, so to speak. And
yeah.
Entropy doesn't affect living systems. It does dead systems, so to speak, like robots and so on. So they thought, hang on a minute, how about hitching into something like the mechanisms these living beings happen to have, and let's then see, by merging ourselves with that, if we can get a kind of eternity,
immortality,
so to speak. You understand?
Yeah.
Big deal, this. This is the big deal. Maybe this is what they were trying to do. And so, and this is what they are trying to do. And maybe this is what explains his abductions and all the rest of it. And then also, it alludes to why Jesus Christ came here and tried to tell us, hang on a minute, be careful. This may be the thing that all of you have to watch in the future. And maybe 2012, signs are pointed which things will be done on this earth that may in fact not allow us to retain our naturalness, that SIM card man-ness, so to speak, in quotes, may be going so far as to threaten the natural aspect of our living nature as beings, living beings with free will, by the insertion, shall we say, they're doing it now, of various, you know, mechanisms into us, ostensibly to cure diseases, whatever. But hang on a minute. Supposing it can also marshal our thinking. It can also stop us being us, so to speak, with the freedom to think and do with imagination and so on. And so here we are. I believe that Jesus came 2,000 years ago to warn us, this is in the process, watch for artificial beings, watch for robots and so on with artificial intelligence, and you guys have your ability to keep on living by coming back or whatever through birth if these guys put inside you their own program for their reasons, if you see what I mean.
Uh-huh.
That's another big deal, Lance.
Huh. Well, well, that's a pretty startling
thought.
In fact, if I may add here, I think that this is probably one of the most dangerous things we face in these times. You know, I think that because we are living beings, as Nigel has just sort of tentatively outlined, you know, if we die, we get killed by a spear or a rock or an asteroid, we can still come back again. We still have the free will available to us to actually observe everything from the point of view that we wish to.
Yeah.
The problem is that as we slowly give away our ability to do that by lending our will to technology, essentially we give them effectively our free will, and therefore we can't actually retain that freedom when we die to come back again, because we're hitched into a more technological framework to do it.
That's right.
And I think that's really scary. Now, the point about Jesus is that he came to save us, and he said all of this 2,000 years ago. But really, I think what you know, Nigel's book ends up with is really discussing almost a gift for us for now, if you see what I mean, in that we now require the technology, and he's actually sort of left us this gift of a shroud, if you like, that his body covering, which in fact we're now looking at with more technology, and I think we'll discuss that more in a minute. Which is actually, actually gives us then, if we understand what that really means, the mechanism by which we can actually get past what these grey aliens are doing so that we can actually retain our ability to continue to know and to be who we are.
Yeah, and that's the crucial thing, you know, Lance. The crucial thing is to retain the power of our will in our own terms of reference as individuals. And I'll give you a little story, maybe, that actually demonstrates this beautifully that comes from the New Testament. You know that if you recall, and I don't know how much Christianity you are familiar with, but there is a reference in the Gospels, I think that it's in Matthew and in Luke, where this individual Jesus Christ was seconded by this being, this individual. They call this being Satan, and this Satan character seemed to have control of the planet because he was offering Jesus all kinds of things, the entire planet, if he worshipped him, you know, in so many words and so on. I think this actually, there's a biblical reference to this. I'll try and find it for you. I think it's in Luke chapter 4, verse 8, you know.
Okay.
And it says there, that this individual, Jesus Christ, said to this character, Satan, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." Now, inasmuch as that is so, there seems to be a battle of authority here, where this individual, Jesus, is saying to Satan, "Look, it's the other way around, Buster. you can't give me anything. It is you who have to follow me." That
right.
might imply that Satan might have been a robot or a roboid or something. Even though he might have all the technology in the world to take Jesus where he wanted to, he was being put in his place by Jesus. Now, the interesting thing is, in the same description, this chap is taken to a high place. And from this high place, you're supposed to see the cities of the world. Now, I looked at this and I thought, this is really fascinating, because there is no church, there is no mountain, there is no building 2,000 years ago high enough to see anything but a surrounding area perhaps of 6, 10, 15 kilometers. Where is it that you could see the cities of the world? If you look at a map of Judea in terms of a two-dimensional flat, you know, plane, so to speak, and if you look at the whole of the known world at the time, actually it fits in a nice square with Judea right in the center. Now, where do you think that you can see all the cities of the world from if you were in Judea? Go 200 miles up into space, and you will see the cities of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, therefore, the connection between these alien beings, robots or not, roboids I think they are, that is the connection between Christ and the roboids that gives us some verity in looking at this whole linking system between all the things that I'm saying. That here we are, here's a link that puts Christ right in with perhaps alien beings. Because, you know, the word Satan, for instance, in ancient mythology, translates out as he who fell from the sky. And there's another hint for you, that something's going on here. Something's wrong in the state of Denmark, so to speak,
right.
to put Hamlet, you know? If you see
what
I mean.
Of course.
And you can see how this is getting really exciting now, you know? And I'm looking at all of this as I uncover this business in my research and so on, and I think, hey, perhaps this is what it's all about. These guys are all in some kind of conspiracy to capture in some kind of way an entire species, and we are lab rats. And then I go back in time and look at the history of man, and I find, I mean, that ancestral line of our species, so to speak, and what do I find? That suddenly, magically, about 200,000 years ago, or maybe less than that, they're not quite sure about this, that our species, the female of the species, develops a pelvis that is huge, that can admit a sudden growth of brain size when previously we were kind of primitive monkey-type hominids or whatever, such that it could admit a huge brain. And maybe out of this, Neanderthals began. Neanderthals, you know, have a larger brain than Homo sapiens. That's us, modern man. Now, something happened that was incredible there, to suddenly make this jump, this capacity within the biology of humanity to produce this incredible size, when for 3 million years previously, nothing like that happened. Now, that's a crazy thing, you know? And so, therefore, I'll just finish this point. And that particular mechanism that produced this particular size differential and perhaps intelligence differential and so on, may be the most incredible thing of all, that we then came from this as thinking beings of high sophistication and so on, and that can only be done through genetic engineering. And this is where I think the interception of a higher intelligence coming here, past E equals MC squared and all of that to our planet, might actually point to the guilty parties. Those things we see now in flying saucers that, you know, your astronauts verify. Your press club recently had some distinguished people saying they are here. There can be no doubt about it, Lance. Something terrifying is going on, and it's been covered up, and this has been hidden from the body politic of humankind, and that is the business of ordinary people who think outside the box to get in there and expose somehow. I'm sorry, I had to go in that line.
I totally agree with you. And there are many people right now making a case for the idea that such as Sitchin, who just passed, and Michael Tellinger, who's leaned heavily on the work of Sitchin, that about 200,000 years ago, the Anunnaki cloned us from the ape-like beings that were here in order to do labor. And there's a mounting evidence that we were cloned for that purpose.
Yeah.
And
well,
that our DNA was limited.
I'm not so sure, you know, in my own terms, can I say that here? I'm not so sure that an intelligence that could come here in that scale of magnitude would want to clone us, to make us simply laborers. I think their technology would be so huge that they wouldn't need laborers to harvest gold or whatever. I think they could get this to happen no problem at all in their own way. I think maybe that was our kind of terrestrial thinking mess, so to speak, that might, you know, this is the kind of thing we would do. We'd make an army of ants or whatever it is to get this, that, or the other. I think they are here for something far more precious than gold and things like that. They are here for our capacity, our human capacity to come back as often as we want, to actually beat the second law of thermodynamics, which rots everything. And I think when they discover there's a simple living species here that can do this, that can have birth happen to them, these machines wanted to know how this was done. And being machines with a program, of course, they have no sense of individuality. A program, something like your vacuum cleaner, doesn't know itself of itself as a vacuum cleaner. But
well, these are supposed to be highly intelligent, and in fact, many people say that they have advanced skills, telepathy, and the ability to change form and to move people, you know, human beings through walls, and to appear as light beings and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but if the technology can actually do things with atoms.
Yes.
We can think as human beings. We have a sense that goes beyond the atom. In order to come back in birth, there must be something that continues. If we accept a factorization like a soul, we have to think outside the physical methodology of an atom as such. We have to go beyond that. And I think that the great religious teachers, you know, in the world were trying to tell us there's an added dimension to natural living things, something wondrous that we might, in fact, end if we are careless about it, through our own volition, not something else outside that's a machine coming and doing it to us, but we ourselves, by not using it judiciously or understanding its propensity, if we did this, we might in fact end ourselves. But what they are trying to do is to try to impose on us a regime that serves their purpose. In fact, we are lab rats to them, and because their technological advancement is so superior to our thinking potential, at least at that time, they have the ascendancy there. But as they did this and our brain capacity rose, the realization returned to us from this primitive monkey species, returned to us, my goodness me, these things are here in time, it occurred to us, these things are here to actually take our propensity, our free will over. And then, of course, what was in the universe before, great beings, soul, if you like, returned to our planet through the mechanism that perhaps Jesus did and so on. And through the shroud, and what we find in the shroud, and this is crucial. I was at Frascati, and Dr. Andrew Silverman, a medical doctor, friend of mine, delivered a dissertation about a book I'd written, and some theory I had about, you know, what the Shroud might well be. And he had his own take on this, and he gave a fantastic dissertation about this that actually riveted all the top scientists in the world sitting there, you know, researching the Shroud, and said some things about it that were absolutely incredible. It's a pity that Andrew's not here to actually to talk about this, but you know, it's really a wonderful revelation, this whole thing. And the whole point is that he said to us, within this frame of reference, that maybe Jesus Christ, this individual, by doing this business, this wonderful, what they call the resurrection, tried to prove to humanity, hang on a minute, fellas, if I can do this, so can you, because you are also naturally living like I am. Here I am trying to show you there's a way to do this. And in that piece of cloth is distance-coded information, the only image in the world that has, in the most incredible way, in its flat two-dimensional surface, a scorch of some blazing type of light that just scorched the surface fibers of this cloth. And in it installed three-dimensional information somehow that machines now at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena in Texas are able to solicit and show, you know, that this thing can come away from the cloth and you can actually see the image of a man that had a crown of thorns on his head and whip marks, a biologically perfect specimen that no pathologist or forensic doctor can fault in its detail. And the most amazing thing, of course, that might sign it as, in fact, the actual body cloth that covered Jesus, was the fact that it had a crown of thorns. And the only person that in history a crown of thorns was reserved for in the death scenario, so to speak, was Jesus Christ. Because if you remember, the Jews, at least the Romans, mocked him with the statement, Jesus Christ, King of the Jews. And it was only to Jesus that a crown of thorns was put on. So it can't be anyone else's body relic. It had to be this one specific person. And I tell you what, I am, after so many years of looking at this business, from being totally skeptical, because you know the church is full of relics and all that through history.
Yeah, I'll living ones.
this one, I tell you, is a genuine article, no question. I'd lay my soul on the line on this.
And well, how do you see that as a tool for us to learn from and to create a body of light
to us, Lance, didn't he? He said to us, don't ye know ye are gods? His words. And he was actually trying, I believe, this wondrous being, to tell us all that we have this incredible capacity and that we've got to guard it because we're living beings that can think and make decisions. And he came here to make sure that maybe we believed in ourselves enough to know that if we thought in a certain way, and he showed us how to do this by his own example, we might in fact be able to escape the grip of a dying mechanism, a universe that has a second law breaking everything up to, you know, in the future, cosmologists now say that the universe is going to be ended. It would be a flat nothingness, cold nothingness, with all atoms unraveled, even subatomic particles taken out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, if it's going to be that finite, if it's going to end like that, why do we have meaning? Why am I talking to you like this? Why do we have meaning right in the middle, so to speak, of all of this? I think Jesus was trying to say, if we live for a state of being beyond death and not a state of being in life, we might find the antidote for anything the greys bring to bear on us. I believe the Shroud of Turin, I'll say this, I'm sorry, I don't wish to sound too much like a preacher, but I really do believe that the Shroud of Turin is the most powerful illustration paradigm to kind of demonstrate the power over atoms of someone who lives for existence beyond the atomic state. And I think that's why this business of being good and all this is required by all the great teachers, not just Jesus. There's Gautama Buddha, there's even, and believe me, you know, don't believe that the great prophet of Islam was a devil. He wasn't at all. It's the people who came after him that mangled his words and do these terrible things to everybody that actually let the side down, as in fact I believe the church did let Jesus down and so on. It's the people who come after that alter their words and so on that actually lay these terrible things on their laps, so to speak. But the great teachers themselves, if you really go and get the pure word that they made, they never said many of the things that, you know, you get said about them today. And so here was this wondrous being mangling his body for us on a cross. The last thing he could say with all that pain and all that injustice powered on him in this piece of wood they call a cross was, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I tell you what, mate, sometimes when something drops on my toe and I jump up and scream and shout, I try and think of this man with all that terrible stuff heaped on him being able to say this. Now, if you can do that, you're very special. And maybe there is something to us adding things together. I think that's what he means by being good, so to speak. Bring things together, unite things, don't break them apart. And the momentum of using our thoughts in this kind of fashion opens up a wonderful future beyond life. Of that I am certain. There really is that we continue. This thing I call a soul is an information field, not of this universe. And you cannot destroy it. It really can be used, it can be borrowed, it can be fixed into something else. But you can't destroy that itself. Rather like oil and water don't mix, the field of a soul, I call it an electrospatial field, a morphogenic electrospatial field, doesn't actually fit with the physicality of our physical universe. It stays and it goes on and on and on. And if we can actually contrive it in a certain way, it goes into another state of being that's wondrous, where all things come together. I call that state the Godverse, if you see what I'm trying to say, for want of a better word. I don't really want to ally that in an anthropomorphic religious sense,
right.
But let's say, if you see what I'm trying to say, I just call it a Godverse, be as secular as I possibly can about this. Maybe call it an Allverse, and that might be even better, if you see what I'm trying to say. People have problems with this God business, you know?
Yeah.
That's the whole point about this. Sorry to go at this tirade pace, but, you know, we've got an hour, and I've got to hitch in 3 books worth of results, Lance. And I do apologize to you, Lance, and I don't mean to kind of hog the whole thing, if you like, but, you know, it really needs saying to introduce the elements. You can ask me for now, you know, little questions on how these things actually connect up together in detail, if you like. And John is there to answer you the scientific biochemical verity of it all, too, if you so want to do. But I just wanted to connect up the soul with the greys and the cloth. And I hope I've done that, however awkwardly, in the last few minutes.
Well, yes. You mentioned, too, that the hybridization program has been stepped up dramatically. And from your research of the data on the abductions, since they first started being noticed, have they increased over the last decade or have they decreased?
Well, they've increased, it seems, Lance. It seems that, according to the two authorities I trust the most, Professor Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, and they really are wonderful people. They've done the best research, to my mind, on this question. And according to them, this is increasing at a pace now. There seems, particularly Professor Jacobs seems to say, that this particular thing is increasing at such a pace that something is up. And I can't verify this, of course, and it's just a speculation, and I have to say this. As much of what I try to say is, but you know, you can't make empirical evidence if something is against you in this world, as most people seem to be that control the mainstream, because they don't want the repercussions of anything like the Greys kind of, you know, taken seriously for all mankind for various reasons, you know, fiscal reasons, whatever. But something there is here and is wrong in the state of Denmark that, so to speak, is hiding this from all of us. And I do really believe that if this is escalating and they are, you know, increasing their efforts to synthesize humankind and our DNA, to alter it so that in some kind of way they can meld their programmed, artificial, mechanistic form of being into ours, then every individual who they can do this to will be interrupted in his natural scale of development. And that scale might preclude that particular individual of an eternity. And that's the terrible thing. That's a big deal. And maybe 2012 doesn't signal the end of the world. It signals the end of natural free thinking. And that, to me, is bigger than the end of the world.
Yes, it would be. It would be. What part do you think the power of the heart plays in our uniqueness? And some say that the heart has a mind of its own that is actually a very small chamber that is actually like our minds. Isn't that a significant difference over a mechanized being to have a heart and to be able to feel and have emotions?
Well, our brain is a colloidal jelly, if you see what I'm trying to say, right?
Yes.
And within the frame of reference of this colloidal jelly, realization occurs, understanding occurs, motive occurs, action is propagated and promulgated, if you see what I'm trying to say. So however the biological presentation, however that may be constructed and construed, whatever our human aegis might be in its physical biochemical mechanism, can I tell you that John Biggerstaff is much better qualified to talk about this than I am. I have to try to be a juggler looking at all the various disciplines possible to put the story together, but then I rely on some really well-trodden paths through some clever minds who've done specific things in specific directions, and John is a very good direction to go to when you talk about biochemistry and so on. And maybe you can ask him about this heart question. He might have a better take than I have on it.
Well, yes. John, what do you think about that? And, you know, your expertise is in molecular and cell biology and microbiology. It seems as if a lot of diseases that are manufactured today are designed in a laboratory, such as AIDS and many other diseases seem to be occurring unnaturally. Is that possible?
Right. Coming to the diseases, but, it may well be that these diseases are being used as genetic vectors to actually get some of these alien encoded signals into us to make us even want the technology even more. But to get to your principle of heart and caring, really, I think what's happening here is that our ability to think is really not part of the physical universe in a way. It's enmeshed within it, and in the living process, it has mechanisms both in biochemistry and etc. by which it is able to interface with a physical system. In the process that we call life. But I think one of the most important things about the concept of heart is really, you know, to reiterate what Jesus and what now Nigel is sort of saying about Jesus really is that, you know, at the beginning of the universe, there was effectively nothing. Then there was a big bang and everything came from that. Well, now we know from physics, for instance, that the ability to observe a process happening actually changes that process. In fact, this was done in the 1930s and 40s by physicists, which actually gave us a really big handle on what this concept of consciousness really is. And so really that places any consciousness between these two master boundaries of, you know, of chaos at one end, which entropy is leading us towards, and really this zero point where everything all comes together as one, which is essentially what we were all in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think that the concept of caring, really, and love and all of those emotional positive qualities tend that when actually acted upon, like on other people, to bring things together. I think that that is the motivation for what the extension of our emotions is. Negative emotions, conversely, yeah, are things which will break things up and increase entropy. So I think that the concept of what thought does in terms of the way we're appreciating it as it's translated through a biological system, I don't think one can really get at it from looking at the handle of the biological system. One has to work out where that thought process is and what its true function is.
Yes, and that really, I think, sums it up in a way. Yes, there is this, you know, Jesus said, think with the heart, Jesus. It's an amazing statement, this. Think with the heart, Judas. Mm-hmm. And if Judas thought with the heart, so to speak, I think it was a metaphor, but I may well have some mechanism, you know, that actually is derived out of brain and the heart, whatever the physicality of it is. And I've read these instances where people have heart transplants and actually inherit the qualities of the individual whose heart was taken for the transplant, if you see what I'm trying to say. And I do know where you're coming from, Lance. And really, yes, within the verity of the living system, remember, blood is magnetic. It's iron. It's ferromagnetic. It's a circuit, you know. Our living system is the movement of blood in a coil in our bodies, which produces electric charges. We have a biomagnetic field, really, basically, by the circulation process of our blood in the body. The heart pumps this around, both the brain and everywhere. So we have, if you like, a kind of biological transducer. You know, rather like a tape recorder transduces sound and transfers that to the speakers, which move air and blast this, you know, recording on the ferrous oxide of the tape, if you see what I mean. I believe that the magnetic component, you know, which is hemoglobin, you know, it's blood, it's ferrous, you know, that somehow this thing can retain, if you like, a kind of static electric picture in that format. And really, I'm out of my expertise here. There may be much cleverer people in this particular field who might be able to make a more cogent statement about this. I'm only trying to talk about what you're saying, really. And maybe I for one, because I think outside the box, will be open-minded enough to welcome any kind of theories how this might be true. And I'm willing to actually accept that, you know, in as much as the heart contains the largest volume of blood per unit area at any given time within our body, that that's where we retain the greatest impressions in terms of a format of recordability, so to speak, of our impressions or whatever. And you take that up, and there is a then fixed thing. You put it in somebody else, a fixed picture, so to speak. You put it in somebody else, and that then when you start that heart up, in a blood system of somebody else, that recording actually plays itself, and the propensities and the magnitudes that are registered there might then make a person, you know, feel and see the kinds of things that the previous owner of that heart had, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
I think that's a very plausible thing, and I do go with you on that. But I don't know, I haven't done any research into this, but I would say that I'd hold hands with you there, really.
Well,
yeah, wonderful. You know, this idea that John brought about caring and all of that, Jesus was trying to say, he always spoke in metaphors, in parables that were beautiful metaphors that meant so many things in simple sentences, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
he was so
economic
with his words, this wonderful master of explanation, so to speak. And the heart is the center, if you like, of our body space, if you call it that. And what I think he was trying to say is that every single human being, in the center of the meaning of that human being, is something extraordinarily special, and that no one needs to feel they are nothing. And I believe most of all, because they can have an eternal propensity, if but they can understand that adding rather than separating and dividing is the clue, is the great tip, is the great hint given by the great teachers.
Yes.
You know, and I think abductees, incidentally, and, you know, when I look at the research into this, I've got to the, okay. Come to the conclusion that if you are an abductee, I would say to them myself, don't despair. I believe abductees are amongst those whom these greys, if they're experimenting on our species, right, are having problems introducing their programs into, so to speak. They have certain successful intercepted biological lines, and those they do not need to pay too much attention to, right? However, with abductees, they've got a problem for some reason. So they're the lucky ones, and they're looking at abductees in this particular way, trying to find out why they can't get whatever they want to do to our human species into abductees or types like that. Interception is thus, you know, not the same as abduction.
That's the good news.
Yeah. To resist interception. Sorry.
We're out of time. We had so much conversation that we're running out of time.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that you mentioned where people can find out more about your work and find your books and so on and so forth.
Not that important, but I mean, it's nigelkerner.com and all the information's there. I really have to say this to you. I'm not one of these individuals who go on shows to kind of hype my book up. There's so much to say in shows like yours to make human beings believe that there's something wonderful going on too. That it's not doom and gloom. That in fact, if we believe the things that the great teachers said to us, then whatever threat there might be, because we are human and we can say no, that's powerful enough.
Absolutely. I want to thank you for being on the show tonight. We'll have to have you back to talk some more, obviously, because we just barely scratched
the
surface.
I'd love to do that.
And
thank you for being such a gracious host.
And it was wonderful talking with both of you, and I wish you continued luck in your research and your third book, and we'll talk again. Thank you both.
More on the biological side, we can do that in the future.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both, gentlemen. It was a great hour, so we'll talk again.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you
All
very
right.
much.
Good night, everybody.